We've learned that this entire book of the New Testament of the Bible is a letter from Paul. And Paul was a post-Jesus Jewish convert to the Way, the name of the time for the teachings of Jesus and the belief that Jesus had come as the Messiah. Paul traveled throughout the Near East, what we know as Israel and Egypt, and across the Mediterranean, to Greece, to Italy, to Turkey. With others, he preached, he taught, and he formed new churches. One of those new churches was in the city of Corinth, letter to the Corinthians. After Paul's time there, as reports began circulating back to him, it became apparent that this church and community were really struggling with trying to live out what it meant to live in the way of Jesus as Christians. If you read the entire letter of 1 Corinthians, you'll find a lot of very specific examples of how they are not living this out. The chapter before this addresses a squabble that they're having over which spiritual gifts are the greatest. Chapter 13 is, 12 chapters into this, pointing out all the things they're doing wrong and addressing them. And it could be a bring on the hammer kind of moment for Paul. Instead, what he says is, if you are not living out love as demonstrated by Jesus while on this earth, you are just making noise. We've been reminded that all of the stories, from creation to Exodus to Noah, the words of the prophets that precede the arrival of Christ, are God's love story with humankind. People were created out of love for the sake of love. The Jewish people would remember this and they would forget it, and they would remember it and they would forget it. Now, just 2 years after having the living example of God on earth, who is Jesus, at most a couple of degrees of separation away from people who would have heard Jesus, touched him, seen Jesus, and known all that he did, the people of the Way are already starting to forget the lessons of love. So in this chapter, Paul eloquently writes of all those lessons lived and taught by Jesus. While we often associate 1 Corinthians 13 with relationships and wedding vows, it is really written not to a marital or a family unit, but to those living in a church community like this one. So we examine this passage by hearing, exploring, and practicing what it means to live in love like Jesus. The chapter begins, "Love is patient and kind." The Gospels, the writing of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are full of stories of a patient and kind Jesus. We read those stories, we hear them, we remember them, and we practice daily, building our patient and kind muscles together. Last week, Chad explored the next phrase, the beginning of the "What Love Is Not" section of the chapter. Love is not rude, arrogant, or boastful. All of those relate to a lack of selfishness, to not relegating others to less than or less important than ourselves, to not giving ourselves license to put ourselves above others in words or thought or action. Also, it doesn't say that we are less than. We're all equally valued and worthy children of God. And we choose how to live out this equality in freedom. When to surrender, when to serve others, when to allow others to hold sway, when to lead, when to follow. And we're called to choose this out of love, not obligation or duty or our own interests. But this week, we move into the next phrase. Love does not insist on its own way. Love is not irritable and keeps no record of being wronged. There is a truism in preaching that you preach the sermons you need to hear, so buckle up, everyone. This is a challenging part of my own life. It's a place where much of what I experienced and learned in childhood was not helpful, and I've had to learn a lot with God in community, in family, in marriage along the way. And I'm still learning, good people, I'm still learning. So we begin. Love does not insist on its own way. Don't we just really like our own way? We really kind of love our own way. It's comfortable, it's known, it's right. It definitely seems like the right way. It's what we need, it's what we want, from whatever source or motivation. Most of us like being at some level of control of what is happening around us most of the time. It's normal, it helps us meet our fundamental needs, safety, shelter, food, in marriage, work, and it helps us create the kind of life that we want, pleasure, comfort, surroundings, love. In marriage, work, or family life, learning how to meet our own needs without insisting on our own way is just an ongoing negotiation. In community life, it gets a bit stickier. There are more voices. I don't have this many people living in my house. I don't know about you. There are more ways. There are more personalities. And a little less vulnerability, a little less knowing of each other, compassion, and truth-telling. There's more elbows being thrown. And remembering our vision series, more jagged snowflake edges of my personality meeting your personality. So as we look at the life of Jesus, we certainly see a leader of people and a follower of God. There's not much record of Jesus insisting on much of anything but loving people. The disciples worried about who was hungry and where they should go next, and likely things like which disciple snored so loudly that nobody wanted to sleep next to them and who had to sleep next to them tonight. In Mark 6:8, we read about Jesus sending his disciples out for the first time on their own. And he told them to take nothing for their journey except a walking stick, no food, no traveler's bag, no money. When you are relying on others, your insistence on having your own way diminishes. Part of releasing control is trust. The disciples had to trust that their needs would be met. They had to trust this little bit crazy rabbi that they were following day by day by day. Jesus had to trust his Father, surrendering his will to God in the most significant of ways. He had to trust in a plan that was even bigger than his own life. Control, insistence, trust, surrender. Where do you live in any moment on that continuum? Let's practice this again. Hold it in your hand, open it, and let it go. Someone after the first service said, I just want to throw it. Can I just throw it? And sure, the answer is sure, you just throw it. Your prayer practice. What happens when we do not get our own way is often found in the next phrase. Love is not irritable. Okay, think about this for a minute. When is the last time you were irritated? Let's just review this morning, shall we? Were you out the door 3 minutes later than you thought you should be? Were you irritated with the alarm clock and went it off an hour earlier than it was supposed to? Did you drive behind someone who's moving too slow or too fast? If you want to check yourself in this chapter, notice what you feel as you drive. spouse finding a parking spot in that most of annoying ways in which they find a parking spot? It doesn't really take much, does it? In my house, none of the 4 travel coffee mugs seem to live in my house right now. Had to use somebody's used Starbucks cup, didn't like it. I followed someone who just was weaving in and out of traffic like they owned the road, and I could just feel this irritation surface in myself. It just happens. Other translations put it in these ways. Love is not easily angered, not provoked, not irritable or touchy, doesn't fly off the handle, doesn't rage, is not easily upset. Most of us can probably locate ourselves somewhere in those descriptions at least once on any given day. There are lots of shades of levels of descriptions here, but they're all forms of anger. We have to be honest. These are all just forms of anger. We're going to spend some time talking about anger at some different levels. I don't feel like we do that a lot in a church. And then we'll circle back to irritable, and we'll all feel a lot better about being irritable at that point. Anger, I believe, gets kind of a bad rap in the church and gets ignored. I think we often just label it as bad, as wrong, as sinful, and we don't want to particularly acknowledge that it exists in us, and we may not know how to manage what does exist. Yet here's the truth. Anger is simply an emotion. It's a primary emotion to the human condition, like fear and sadness and joy. It's given to us by God to counter physical threats to our lives and safety. And I think that's one of the reasons we feel it on the road. A person in a 3,000-pound vehicle who runs a stop sign is a threat to us. Anger is kind of a natural emotion that we feel in response. The problem, of course, is that many, probably most, of the things we find ourselves angry about aren't threats to our lives. They're just threats to our ego, to our sense of well-being, our insistence on having our own way, our sense of order and control. They arise from hurt, disappointment, fear, embarrassment, other emotions that are rattling around in our beings. So when you think of anger, what do you think about? One of the forms is rage, wrath, fury, hatred, consuming anger, the Bruce Banner turning into the Hulk kind of anger. If you've seen Inside Out, the anger is the little guy whose head explodes in flames. Sometimes it feels like that. That kind of anger is scary. It's scary whether it's your own emotion that some just feels suddenly like it's gone out of control, whether it's directed at you, or whether you just happen to be in the room or on the road with other people while it's happening. There's a tremendous amount of energy in that kind of anger. And it's an energy that tends to want to fly outward like arrows until it finds a target. If you've ever been on the receiving end of someone's uncontrolled, raging anger, you likely know this. Anger can burn. It can burn the psychological skin of a child or a loved one. As we watched uncontrolled anger in the world, we can literally watch it burn a city down. Uncontrolled, unexamined, unrepentant anger is damaging, always to ourselves and often to others. If you find yourself in this place of emotion more than rarely, consider this a wake-up call. You need to seek some help. There are roots and reasons for this anger that need some digging up, but they also need some care and light and love, some help and some healing. Hold yourself accountable for working on this issue. We'll talk in a moment about Jesus' exhibition of another kind of strong anger. But there are absolutely no examples of Jesus exhibiting harmful, raging, vengeful anger. And that alone tells us where it belongs in our spirit. But there is a different shade of anger, maybe described as passion or zeal, that can be a tool for change, for positive change, for change in our lives. On a level of justice, anger can be fuel and motivation. Was Jesus ever that kind of angry? You bet he was. Three of the Gospels describe this scene in the Temple of Jerusalem. This particular one is from Mark. Mark 11, verses 15 through 18. Jesus clears the temple is the title of the passage. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple area and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, "It is not written that my house will be called Is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers, a den of thieves is the phrase that we may know. So we think of Jesus flipping tables, you know, Real Housewives kind of flipping tables going on here. And that seems scary. I choose to believe no doves were harmed in the flipping of the tables. In John, this is described as passion for God's house, for God's holiness or worship. What Jesus saw in that temple angered him so much that change needed to happen right away. Jesus showed anger in a synagogue when the Pharisees put law ahead of Jesus' desire to heal someone. He looked around at them in anger, deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. I imagine that Jesus was this kind of angry when he was part of the encounter between a woman caught in adultery and a circle of people with judgment and stones and violence on their hearts. There are lots of ways that this scene could have played out. It would have been a natural place for kind of that zeal and righteous, take charge, let them have it, anger. But Jesus calmly, quietly asked the questions that turned the situation on its head, spared the woman while directing that she go and sin no more. And I think of people who have made great change in our world in the last half century. Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa. The injustices that each of them encountered were profound. Oppression, extreme poverty, racial apartheid. Yet all of them are known for turning their anger, and they were angry, at the unjust system in which they lived into nonviolent, direct, world-changing action. If you are angry as you watch the news, as you read the newspaper, as you watch what happens in our community, use it to fuel your loving action to make the world a better place for all. When we prayed this morning, we prayed these words, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Use your anger to fuel change. So we have raging anger and we have passionate, zealous anger. But the anger that is most directly reflected in this passage and that most of us experience more on a daily basis is a bit cooler than both of those. Thank God. Consider these other descriptions. Resentment, bitterness, exasperation, frustration, aggravation, tension, perfectionism, annoyance, grouchiness, grumpiness, irritability. We're all kind of in trouble here, aren't we? None of them sound like very much fun to feel on a personal level or to live with, but neither are emotions like anxiety or sadness. I'm going to say this again. Anger and all those shades of anger is simply an emotion. It's just an emotion. Normal anger, everyday anger in those shades can just be our own internal reaction to life. Some of us are wired this way. Some of us are raised this way. But it can also be a warning signal, a check engine light for us, if you would. Can be a warning signal that we're holding on to our ideas of control, of having our way too tightly, and it's time to let go. Can be a warning signal that we need to reset a boundary. What we're responsible for and we're not responsible for, what we will allow in our lives and what we will not allow, what we will do and what we will not do. It can irritate you that you always seem to dishes. Why am I doing the dishes? I'm doing the dishes again. Why nobody else ever does the dishes? Or you can renegotiate the who does the dishes question in your household, ideally when you're not irritated. Works better that way. Anger can be a warning signal that we're tired, off balance, not getting enough sleep, have too much work, stress, illness, hormones, deadlines, demands, the stuff of life happening, and that we need to pull back the throttle, get some rest, and take care of ourselves. I'm going to add a simple spiritual practice to the let go prayer. And I'm going to ask you to just put your hand kind of in the middle of your stomach and close your eyes and just breathe deeply. And as you exhale, just say the words, "I'm okay," to yourself. So we're going to do this 3 times together. So hand on stomach, eyes closed. Inhale, and "I'm okay." Once. Second time, breathe in, "I'm okay." Third time, breathe in, "Lord, help me." Open your eyes. Good job. You are just hanging in here. So to create your own mantra that helps you find your own words that just help you find your center. That's really what that practice is about. You can kind of keep, feel your emotions flying and your spirit get agitated. Most of the time, what's happening does not matter. It just matters to you, and your body is reacting, so just find your center and breathe. I don't know if Jesus did that particular spiritual practice, but I think he found his center all the time. And you can see that centering, that taking time to be with God present throughout the Gospels. What Jesus did not seem to be was easily angered or irritated or grouchy. And there are so many reasons that he could have been. One of the part of the writing of the Gospels that kind of tickles me is that they're just filled with examples of people, including the disciples, sometimes mostly including the disciples, being slow to get the point, being rude, impatient, selfish, critical, demanding, and exasperating. These are just people living life with Jesus. I really have to imagine that from the human side of himself, Jesus rolled his eyes once in a while. It's not recorded anywhere, but it's in my imagination. But his every action and response was born out of this center, this endless well of love. The gifts of the Spirit of Christ within us are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. Let's just keep walking with Jesus, good people. Let's just keep letting the Spirit have its way with us. We're okay. We just need to keep breathing and practicing. And then we come to the last statement in this verse. Love keeps no record of wrongs. In other translations, it's written as holds no grudges, does not keep score, is not resentful, will hardly even notice when others get it wrong. And my favorite, holds no wrong feelings in the heart. Doesn't that just feel good? I love that phrase. We will for sure feel anger. We'll find ourselves irritated, annoyed, frustrated, exasperated, and perhaps even enraged by others from time to time. We will likely also annoy, frustrate, exasperate, irritate, and enrage other people, despite our best efforts. So what do we do? In the Jan Karen Mitford series of books, if you are familiar with that, there are two young people, Dooley and Lacey, both survivors of very rough, traumatic childhoods. In college, they're falling in love, they're trying to make their way, thinking about creating a life together. And they have t-shirts made that say this: love is an act of endless forgiveness. Let that sit in your spirit for a moment. Love is an act of endless forgiveness. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespassed against us. We talk about the place of grace a lot in this congregation. We are not meant to hold wrongs against others. How can we deny others the grace that was so freely given to us? The spiritual practice for this one we likely know well. God, may I forgive others as I have been forgiven. Let it go. Breathe deeply. pray. In closing, I offer this. I was struck as I listened to the messages in this series last week, preparing to write this one, by this observation. When the worship design team planned this message series, the merger proposal process wasn't even on the map. This was dreamed as a Lenten series about the greatest offering of love ever given. Yet here we are. We've been practicing all of this for many years, and now God has us spending some more time in this timing, learning and building these muscles as we prepare to live this out in community in new and challenging ways. I invite the praise team to return as I close. Love is patient, it is kind. It is not rude, nor boastful, nor self-seeking. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable and does not keep record of wrongs. These are directions on how to live life like Jesus. May the power of the Holy Spirit give life to these words in our personal lives, in our life together in community, in the merger proposal process, on the road, and in the world. May we follow the example of Jesus, loving others for the sake of the transformation of the world. May we let go, breathe deeply, and practice the endless act of forgiveness called love.